Welcome, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. The National Security Agency collection of U.S. phone records is deemed unconstitutional, probably. That's big news this week. Federal Judge Richard Leon declared that the mass collection of data by the NSA likely violates the Fourth Amendment, prohibiting unreasonable search and seizure. So what does that mean for the future of national security and for privacy protection? A new nonprofit dedicated to protecting whistleblowers and exposing law-breaking, corruption, and mismanagement in government has just been created here in San Francisco. We'll hear how the founder plans to protect the First Amendment. Also, this is the anniversary of the brutal gang rape in Delhi that made international headlines. And this week, an Indian diplomat was arrested in New York for allegedly paying her nanny much less than the diplomat declared she would in a visa application. Sandeep Roy joins us from India to talk about the diplomatic furor which erupted and complicated labor relations going global. And we also want to hear from you. What stories are you following this week? Where did you hear the best news? And what do you want to know more about? Joining us to talk about the week's news, Dan Roberts is The Guardian's Washington Bureau Chief covering politics and U.S. national affairs, and he joins us from D.C. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Holly. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for being with us. Trevor Tim is co-founder and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. It's a new organization dedicated to supporting cutting-edge transparency journalism focused on bringing accountability to government. Hi, Trevor.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Sandeep Roy, who is our own at KALW, is the culture editor for firstpost.com. He's also a commentator for Morning Edition on NPR. Hi, and he's joining us from Kolkata, India. Hi, Sandeep.
Hi, Ali.
Nice to have you on. Well, as we always do on Fridays, we're going to start the show on a positive note and ask for you to share a story or a journalist that did a particularly good job covering the week's news. So why don't we start with you, Dan? What did you think was done particularly well?
Well, I have a slightly odd one in that it's a piece by Adam Barron in Foreign Policy magazine called The Red Wedding, which I thought was a great spot, largely because it was writing about what nobody else had been writing about, which was last week's drone strike in Yemen, which killed about a dozen people in a wedding. And he makes the point that almost nobody's writing about this. This is astonishing, kind of after Obama's speech on drone policy. Here we are with the U.S. still killing a dozen people in a wedding with drones. And Adam's piece, I thought, was just a really good reminder that we forget this stuff.
Well, thank you. We'll put a link to all of this at yourcallradio.org. How about you, Trevor? Anything you want to shout out to?
Well, there was a story just this morning, actually, when in a huge partnership with the New York Times, The Guardian, and Der Spiegel reporting on a new NSA scandal where they've been spying on UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Charity, a medical charity in France, and a bunch of business leaders and European Commission leaders in Europe. And it just, both or all three of the papers reported on this morning, and it just goes to show that this NSA story isn't dying down anytime soon, and there seems to be a lot left we have to learn from these Edward Snowden documents.
Indeed, and we'll talk about that more. Sandeep, how about you? Something that you want to tell us about either here in the U.S. or internationally?
I wanted to actually mention, it's not so much an article as a cover. So India Today is the magazine that's kind of like Time or Time in India. It's a weekly news magazine, the most popular and widely read one. And this week, it has on the cover the writer Vikram Seth, who is known mostly to Bay Area listeners, especially as the person who wrote The Golden Gate. And then he wrote the novel Suitable Boy, one of the best-known Indian writers writing in English today. And the picture of him is like a mugshot. And he's standing there. It's a black-and-white picture. He looks very rumpled in a white T-shirt, mugshot, brow furrowed. And he's holding a sign in front of him, and it says, "Not a criminal." And underneath it says, "To not be able to love the one you love is to have your life wrenched away." And this is, of course, in reference to the fact that India's Supreme Court recently reinstated its ban on what it calls unnatural sex, which it predominantly translates to gay sex. And that caused a huge uproar in India, enormous protests and everything, because that ban had been lifted by a lower court a few years ago. So the fact that it was brought back and reinstated caused huge furor. And Vikram Seth is one of the few sort of celebrity writers who has decided, and a very private man, has decided to come out into the forefront and not just be public and visible about it, but has put himself up in the mugshot, as a mugshot on the cover, to drive home the point about what criminality means. And it's also really interesting because until now, most of the covers that dealt with this issue, the photographs, have tended to be about two men wearing masks at some pride parade kissing. And this is in a really landmark cover, and there's a story, an essay, which he's written with it. But the cover has caused an enormous stir and already kind of gone viral in India.
And Sandeep, how is that Supreme Court decision being met in India? You talk about protests, but do you think that, I mean, this is the Supreme Court. Where do you go next to overturn this law?
Well, what is in fact happening, and I actually went to a public meeting that was happening in Kolkata today with activists all around the city and state coming together in preparation for a larger meeting this weekend, is that it looks like the pressure and the uproar across civil society, not just from LGBT activists, has actually had an enormous impact, to the point that the ruling Congress party, which is governing the coalition, has decided on that this coming Monday, it will file a review petition in the Supreme Court, asking the Supreme Court basically for a larger bench to review this decision. Whether, you know, because two judges basically decided this. So they're asking for, they have two options before them, well, three really. One is they could go the ordinance route and change the law. One is they could go full-fledged to Parliament itself at the legislative route, which seems difficult because the main opposition party has come out in support of the law. Or they could go to the Supreme Court asking it to review it. So they've opted right now for that, the last strategy.
And this is a colonial-era law that banned all so-called homosexual acts and makes them punishable by up to 10 years in prison.
Well, it bans all unnatural sex. Actually, it is unlike the U.S. Lawrence versus Summers case, which was about this, you know, the act of sodomy or homosexual sex. This actually bans all unnatural, what it calls unnatural sex. So technically, oral sex or something between heterosexuals is also banned under this law. It just so happens that it's mostly, when it's been used, it's mostly been used against homosexuals.
And is it being used as mostly sort of a threat, or is it actually being prosecuted?
It's mostly used as a threat. In fact, one of the reasons the Supreme Court gave in deciding not to strike down the law was that the law has been around since 1861, and they said the case history for it is quite low. It's like about 200 cases that have been prosecuted under it. So they basically, through rather convoluted reasoning, decided that not enough people had been affected by it. Why that affects the law's constitutionality, I don't know. I would have assumed even if one person's rights are violated, it could be unconstitutional. No, but anyway, they've decided that to go about it this way, which means but what it doesn't take into account is countless times the law is used as a threat, as a bludgeon by a policeman who is looking for a bribe, maybe, or something against people, instead of just counting the times it's actually come to court.
Well, and Sandeep, interestingly, it's being used as a bit of a political bludgeon in this diplomatic furor over India's Deputy Consul General Devyani Khobragate. I don't know if I'm going to butcher her name. She was Thank you. She was briefly arrested and charged in New York. She's at the UN for providing false information in a visa application for her nanny, who she allegedly paid $3.31 an hour. And she says she faced indignities of repeated handcuffing, stripping, cavity searches, and was held up
which
with...
which apparently are not true right now, according to Peter.
This is what she alleged. And, I mean, it's creating this big diplomatic furor and political upheaval. Can you just tell us what's happening and then how they're using this new anti-gay law as kind of a threat against U.S. officials?
Yeah, this whole thing, Holly, has actually blown up in a way that probably Preet Bharara, the attorney, did not expect. It's to become such an enormous diplomatic incident where now John Kerry is calling and trying to mollify the Indians. So what people are not arguing about, I think there are two strands to this story which are getting mushed up by interested parties. One is whether this diplomat knowingly and fraudulently underpaid this woman she had brought as a domestic help, basically saying one thing on the visa application, but in reality doing a separate agreement whereby she paid her much less. So that's one, which is sort of a labor and visa fraud story. And then there's a second one, a strand of the story, is how much diplomatic immunity was Debiani Kobragade allowed, and whether the U.S. violated certain diplomatic protocol in the way it treated her in the arrest. So in India's case, India is up in arms about the second part of it, where they have stated rather surprisingly and astonishingly that the only victim in this whole scenario is Debiani. And they've taken it up as an issue of national pride. India has elections coming up next year. So both the government and the opposition see a lot of political capital in standing up to the U.S., and so they snubbed a visiting U.S. delegation. They have removed barriers around the U.S. consulate here, which have been up around and cleared it. They've threatened to start looking at the records of how much the U.S. consulate pays all the Indians that who work here. A lot of tit-for-tat measures.
Mm-hmm.
And as you mentioned, one of the senior politicians said, well, now according to our laws, with our newly reinstated unnatural sex laws, gay sex is illegal in this country now. So we're going to look at all the U.S. consular officials who have same-sex partners who've got visas on as companions, and then we can arrest them as well. So they're now sort of using that as a sort of a political bludgeon as well. But everyone's up in arms because they think that India's honor has been manhandled literally in the U.S.'s treatment of this diplomat. Interestingly, some people have commented that the Debiani is not the only Indian in this story. It's like, what about the domestic help? She is Indian too. What about her honor?
Well, and that's one thing that's really interesting about this case is it kind of exposes the dark side of labor in India. You write, we might come from a country where labor is cheap and no one raises an eyebrow that millions of Indians come to our homes every day to cook and clean 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and have their pay docked when they fall sick and don't make it to work. Just because our diplomats' nannies live in Manhattan and not in Mumbai does not mean that they should not be grateful and not gripe about being paid according to U.S. labor laws. Do you think that this is changing the conversation about labor conditions inside of India at all, Sandeep? I know you seem to be trying to do that.
Not enough. Because, I mean, I think the disparity is so high. There are so many poor people who desperately need the work. They will agree to work at all times, for very little money. But in fact, there are several domestic worker organizations like the Gharelu Kamgar Sangathan, and they've said that our newspaper today quoted one of their members who is a domestic help named Renu as saying, at least my employers don't beat me up, but this woman, meaning Debiani, is lucky that a foreign government is talking about her salary. I cannot imagine it.
That's Sandeep.
The question about minimum wage, and another domestic help who has written a book said, what is minimum wage? I have no idea what it means.
Sandeep Roy is culture editor for firstpost.com. He's also a commentator for Morning Edition on NPR. He's joining us from Kolkata, India. We're also joined by Dan Roberts, who's The Guardian's Washington Bureau Chief, and Trevor Tim, who's co-founder and executive director of the new Freedom of the Press Foundation. You're listening to our Friday weekly media roundtable. I'm Holly Kernan, and you can join our conversation about the week's news by calling 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. 8255. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can post stories that you think that others would like to read about at our website, which is yourcallradio.org. We're going to be talking about the NSA story, how it's evolving since it broke back in June. We'd also like to hear what you think of Edward Snowden. What should happen to him? His fate hangs in limbo in Moscow. Do you consider him a whistleblower, a patriot, a criminal? 866-798-TALK. 866-798-8255. And where did you see the best reporting this week? What do you think about the coverage of India's anti-gay legislation being upheld this month and the Indian diplomat's arrest for alleged labor violations? Give us a call at 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. All right, let's turn to this huge story that just keeps getting bigger and bigger, Dan. On Monday, Judge Richard Leon declared that the mass collection of Americans' telephone records by the NSA probably violates the Fourth Amendment. He's expecting that the government will appeal this. So how significant is this ruling?
I think it's probably the most significant reaction so far to this story. And that's saying something in a week where we've also had a White House review panel come up with 40 recommendations for change, and most of Silicon Valley troop into the White House on Tuesday also demanding change. So in the context of some monumental stuff this week, I think that court judgment stands out. And it stands out for two reasons, really. I think the first one is that the judge was very dismissive of the argument that what was revealed as being done in the name of national security. Like the White House review panel, actually, he concluded that there was virtually no evidence that the bulk collection program that Snowden revealed was helping the U.S. stop terrorism. And I think the second most significant thing about it was that it opens the door for an awful lot more legal challenge. He not only made it clear that ordinary citizens have standing to bring these kind of cases, but pretty much demolished the argument that this was constitutionally defendable anyway. So I think this is the tip of a much bigger iceberg legally. And probably of all the three branches of government now attacking the NSA, I think the courts are the one that they have to be most worried about.
And are you expecting President Obama to address this in his press conference that's coming up in about a half hour?
Yes, we think he will. He will be asked about it. We're trying to ask him about it. It's pretty difficult to get the White House to answer questions from us at the moment, but we're doing what we can, and I'm sure my colleagues elsewhere in the White House press room will try too. He has to. This is the big domestic policy and foreign policy question for him in the next few weeks and the next few months. He's got this report sitting on his desk. They promised an answer by the State of the Union on January 28th. And pretty much whatever he does, he's going to disappoint some people. He's got the entire intelligence community breathing down his neck. Former CIA NSA boss Michael Hayden this week said it was time for the intel community to man up and tell Obama that this was dangerous and reform would put lives at risk. So, you know, the stakes couldn't be higher for Obama.
And, Tim, as Dan was just saying, the judge questioned the NSA's rationale that widespread data collection has been and is necessary for preventing terrorist attacks. How do you think that the media has done so far in kind of challenging the NSA narrative about this?
Well, I think they've gotten better and better as this has gone along. I think a lot of news organizations, you know, excluding The Guardian, who's obviously been on this since the beginning, were a little hesitant at first. And as the story has unraveled, I think that they have done a better and better job. You know, we've seen a lot of great reporting from The Guardian and The Washington Post on the Snowden documents. But the underreported story is that there have been a handful of major news organizations that have done follow-up reporting that has been incredibly revealing. I mean, The New York Times revealed a few months ago that the NSA was scanning large portions of email going into and out of the United States. That wasn't reported in the Snowden documents, or it wasn't as reported as overtly, and they got U.S. government officials on the record. You know, the Wall Street Journal had a big story talking about how the NSA touches 75% of the United States internet traffic, which was another huge story. And, you know, we've seen this time and again where these major organizations that didn't necessarily have the Snowden documents at first have been doing a good job pressuring the NSA. Now, of course, you know, that's not necessarily true for everyone. You know, we've seen other news organizations, you know, really kind of toe the government line here and not actually try to push back on any of these claims. Many of these claims that now have been shown false, like you just mentioned, the fact that this stopped 54 terrorist attacks has now been even admitted by General Alexander to be a gross exaggeration. You know, the 60 Minutes piece just a week ago now was basically a an advertisement for the NSA. You know, they didn't have one dissenting voice on there, and the questions were just softballs lobbed in there so that the NSA chief could you know, answer any way he wants without any pushback. But, you know, by and large, I think now, especially given these rulings and how much it seems the American people care, that the U.S. media has really stepped up and provided some good coverage.
And let's talk a little bit about the 60 Minutes story, because it's getting a lot of criticism from journalists. It was done by a reporter, John Miller, and he had to give this disclosure at the top. I once worked in the office of the director of national intelligence, where I saw firsthand how secretly the NSA operates, and it's really considered essentially an apology for NSA, or basically the perspective of the NSA in that piece. What did both of you think of that segment, Trevor and Dan?
Well, you know, I think, you know, that pretty much says it all, that the fact that they had a reporter who used to literally work for the agency that oversees the NSA, you know, the director of national intelligence, the current head, James Clapper, was caught lying in front of Congress because of what was revealed in the Snowden documents. And he said in this interview, John Miller said in this interview afterwards, that he wanted the NSA to be able to tell their side of the story. He thought that Edward Snowden and his allies had spoken enough. And that's just not how, you know, 60 Minutes is supposed to work, or at least that the American people have grown up learning that you know, 60 Minutes is this hard-hitting investigative news outlet that's supposed to expose government wrongdoing, not let them cover it up. And I think it was just a giant disappointment, not even to just you know, people who are following these issues closely, but you know, many reporters who were just tuning in because it was 60 Minutes were frankly quite shocked, I think.
I think I would agree with that, although I would say that the heartening thing about the program was that the reaction was universally the one that Trevor has just so eloquently described. I haven't found one person, one commentator, who has had a nice thing to say about it. And I think that is in stark contrast with the reaction when the story first started appearing, when you had people on Meet the Press asking Glenn Greenwald whether he should be arrested. And it's also in stark contrast, I have to say, with the way the story has been reported back home in my own country, in the UK, where Fleet Street, I'm afraid, hasn't showered itself in glory and has been very much along the CBS school of thought, with one former newspaper editor sort of saying, you know, who are we to question the intelligence services? So, you know, I think the heartening thing, actually, as Trevor first pointed out, is that the bulk of the U.S. press has taken the story and run with it and has done some fantastic reporting.
And Sandeep, we only have about a minute before the break, so you can maybe start and then tell us a little bit more after the break. But how is the NSA spying being covered in South Asia, in India, and in Pakistan?
Well, it's been covered mainly as a foreign news story, of course. But now, currently, because of the other furor happening in the MAID and diplomatic story, it is being covered also as evidence of, look, we knew the Americans were not to be trusted.
Oh.
It fits into that narrative.
Americans not to be trusted. That's a narrative globally. Sandeep Roy is culture editor for FirstPost.com. Dan Roberts is The Guardian's Washington bureau chief, covering politics and U.S. national affairs. Trevor Timm is co-founder and executive director of the new Freedom of the Press Foundation, which is dedicated to bringing transparency and accountability to government. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call, and we'll be right back after this short break.
The stories that you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable will be posted on our website, yourcallradio.org. We'd also like to invite you to join in the conversation, highlighting the reporting that you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Coming up in 30 minutes, we will be preempting our regular broadcast of World Have Your Say from the BBC to bring you live anchored coverage of President Obama's press conference beginning at 11. He's expected to discuss the economy, health care, and the NSA, among other topics. Again, that's coming up at 11 here on Local Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and find out what's coming up next. On Monday, we'll bring back a conversation about the Center for Investigative Reporting's report, America's Worst Charities. It found that hundreds of charities claim to help those in need, but of the millions of dollars raised each year, how much goes to cancer patients, disabled veterans, and dying children? Almost nothing, according to the report. So what questions should we be asking about the organizations we donate to? Who's doing the most good with your dollars? That's on Monday's Your Call. And if you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also join our conversation about the week's news, and particularly about the NSA spying scandal and recent revelations, including a judge's deeming it likely unconstitutional, the blanket collection of phone data from Americans. 866-798-8255 is the number to call. Again, that's a toll-free number, 866-798-TALK. And our panel today, we've got Sandeep Roy, who's the culture editor for firstpost.com. Dan Roberts is the Guardian's Washington bureau chief. And Trevor Tim is co-founder and executive director of the new Freedom of the Press Foundation. We'll find out more about that in just a moment. Sandeep, I didn't mean to cut you off before the break. Did you have more to say about how the NSA scandals are being covered in India? You had said that it's mostly seen as a kind of the U.S. can't be trusted story.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the new twist to it. Before, it was being covered basically in kind of the foreign news page as when it was not covered in great detail, but it would be covered as a story, you know, as part of stories about U.S. Now it becomes part of a larger narrative that shows American perfidiousness and high-handedness, you know, that they go. As an example of what you're hearing right now, especially in this climate after the diplomatic uproar, is about American double standards, that they say one thing and they do something else completely. And the data mining is, and say, is being taken as another example of, like, yes, they talk very much about being a nation of laws and, you know, one law, and Preet Bharara in the diplomat's case says, you know, the same law applies to every person, American or non-American, rich or poor, who is living in the United States. But then they say, look, this is also what they're doing.
And let's go to a caller before we let you go, Sandeep. TJ in San Jose, welcome to Your Call.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. You had asked earlier at the start of this program whether Snowden is a hero or a traitor, and I guess I'm sort of feeling both because on the one hand, he made the disclosures about domestic surveillance and the scope of that, but then he made those disclosures about surveillance of China and Russia and those sorts of things that really do seem to be the acts of a traitor, if you will, under, as we would think of it, unless I'm missing something about those acts. Is there any further development on them?
Why don't we hear from Dan and Trevor? How do you view Snowden? In a statement, Snowden said this week that the ruling had justified his disclosures. He said, I acted on my behalf, on my belief that the NSA's mass surveillance programs would not withstand a constitutional challenge and that the American public deserved a chance to see these issues determined by open courts, he said in comments released through Glenn Greenwald, the former Guardian journalist who received the leaked documents from Snowden. So does this vindicate Snowden? How do you both view him? Dan, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, well, I mean, you won't be surprised to hear I'm more sympathetic, but I would acknowledge that I think this has been the biggest question right from the outset, and it's a very complicated question, and I think the caller is right to distinguish between the domestic position, where this court ruling this week and the review, I think, are both important supports for Snowden's position. I think the international position, he would argue, we would argue, we've been very careful that we haven't disclosed anything that's given away any operational advantage to America or Britain's enemies. I think what's also really important here is that the majority of the international disclosures have been of targets that, on their very nature, of, it's impossible to conceive how there is a terrorist advantage, an anti-terrorist advantage, or a security advantage. The UNICEF disclosures today, for example, or the calls on intercepting Angela Merkel's telephone calls in Germany. I mean, the uproar internationally has not been about the idea that the NSA spies on the Russians. I don't think even the Russians have a problem with that. I think the uproar has been on the idea that America and Britain's allies are just as much of a target, and that, I think, is what we should judge Snowden about.
How about you, Trevor? How do you think we should be looking at Snowden?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree with what Dan said. I think we have to go back to what Snowden originally said when he gave his first interview, that actually he was giving this to these journalists not so they could reveal sources and methods and not so they could reveal sensitive, specific targets, but he wanted to expose the mass surveillance of Americans, the mass surveillance of people in Europe and in India and our allies. The United States government and the UK government can't point to anything specific that has been released so far that has been damaging to national security. Certainly, it's been embarrassing, given the fact that the NSA is spying on or was spying on Angela Merkel and potentially other leaders in Europe. Edward Snowden has made clear that he didn't want to just dump all this information out on the internet so that sensitive targets in China and Russia could be exposed. And so far, 99% of the stories haven't even touched on China and Russia. They've just been about our allies and in the U.S. And so, I think that's important to keep in perspective when you're thinking about, what you think of Edward Snowden and whether, he deserves to be charged under the Espionage Act. Given that the fact that the Espionage Act was written to punish spies who sell secrets to other countries, not people who give information to journalists to get that information out to the American public. And, I think there's a critical distinction there that's lost on the Justice Department.
And Sandeep, before we say goodbye to you, is there anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I think the only thing I would add in light of this discussion is that there has been a lot of talk here in terms of exactly this point as to that India had thought of itself as having a special relationship with the United States and that it was a very good friend. And I think part of the insult people feel is when, for example, India's foreign secretary was in the United States, I think, right before this arrest was made. And she was particularly upset that she had not been informed, even though she just left the United States right after that the arrest was made. So this whole spying scandal, the listening in on your friends' in friendly countries' conversations, whether it's Germany or India, points for the Indians is a larger thing where they feel like in this current situation they cultivated a special relationship with the United States, which had been solidified by Obama's visit here and Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh going there, and they feel like a lot of that has to stand exposed as being not meaning very much in the larger scheme of things, because when push comes to shove, it's as if the country had gotten strip searched, which is not true at all. But that is the level at which the emotions are playing out.
So it's almost a metaphor for U.S. Indian relations. Well, thank you, Sandeep Roy. Sandeep is the culture editor for FirstPost.com. He's also a commentator for Morning Edition on NPR, and he joined us from Kolkata, India. Thanks, Sandeep.
Thank you.
Thank you, Holly.
We're also joined for our Friday Media Roundtable by Dan Roberts, who's the Guardian's Washington Bureau Chief. He's covering politics and U.S. national affairs. He joins us from Washington, D.C. And Trevor Tim is co-founder and executive director of the new Freedom of the Press Foundation, which is dedicated to bringing transparency and accountability to government. And that's what we're talking about on this week's Media Roundtable. You can join our conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. It's 866-798-8255. What do you think about how the NSA story has evolved? How does it affect you? How has it affected international standing of the U.S.? And what do you think of Edward Snowden and his revelations? Is he a patriot? What should happen to him? He's in limbo in Moscow. And how have you appreciated the media coverage and the information released about the NSA's domestic and global spying operation? What do you want to hear from President Obama in this press conference coming up? Our number is 866-798-TALK. Again, it's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. And Trevor, before we run out of time, I want to hear about this new project, the Freedom of the Press Foundation. What is it, and why did you think you needed to start it now?
Sure. Well, we started Freedom of the Press Foundation just under a year ago. And, you know, on our board of directors is Dan Ellsberg, the famous Pentagon Papers whistleblower, Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras, the two reporters who originally broke the Edward Snowden story. And, you know, our goal was really to point out the increasing hostility that the U.S. government has towards sources and the press. You know, in the past 6 or 7 years, we've seen more whistleblowers prosecuted under the Espionage Act than all other administrations combined, which, you know, is a really scary proposition for those who care about information and those who have seen over the same time period the government get more secretive and more secretive. You know, more information is being classified, less is being released to the public. You know, we also started our organization because WikiLeaks, when they started publishing the State Department cables 3 years ago, were cut off by private companies like Visa, MasterCard, and PayPal from receiving donations, even though they were doing some of the same publishing that you know, newspapers like the New York Times do. So we started taking donations to them. We also take donations to a variety of other important, innovative journalism organizations that don't necessarily get a lot of attention. And, you know, we hope to, you know, explain to people that these are the types of organizations that need our support if we want to keep our free press strong. And, you know, lately what we've been doing is trying to draw attention to this technology problem that we have where, you know, we've seen all these stories in the past 6 months about NSA surveillance really emphasize that technology is allowing the government to conduct the surveillance. And when they can conduct the surveillance on ordinary people, they can conduct it on sources and journalists. And that's a big part of the reason why we've seen so many prosecutions of sources. And so we're really trying to emphasize that journalists need to learn this digital security so that they can protect their sources in the digital age. You know, we've, you know, in the decades preceding here, we've, you know, reporters had always protected their sources by refusing to testify against them and, you know, even go to jail to protect them. But now the government's figured out that they don't need to call journalists to testify against their sources anymore. They can just subpoena their emails and phone calls. And so we really want to draw attention to this issue and hopefully educate journalists on how to protect themselves.
And Dan, that's something that journalists at The Guardian have really been grappling with in the wake of all of this NSA data from Snowden. And you guys had your offices kind of raided by the British government, in fact.
Yeah, I think this is one of those areas where the U.S. actually should be very proud, despite the huge challenges that Trevor rightly identifies for journalists operating here. The First Amendment is still an enormously important symbol, if hopefully more than that as well, in terms of protection of journalism. And we in the U.K. Had a very different experience where we had our hard drive smashed up by spies from GCHQ. We've had the editor hauled before a committee of Parliament to explain and asked whether or not he was a patriot. I mean, really, stuff that, I mean, I've been in British journalism for 20 years before I was here, and I was shocked by the lack of protection for freedom of speech and for journalism that it revealed. And I think that there are similar challenges in the US, but the global challenge is the most important. If we can't establish a precedent that the press is there to hold governments and power to account in countries like the US and Britain, then what hope do we have in countries where there are brutal dictatorships?
Yeah, I should say that originally we started because of what was happening in the U.S., but we want to really be a global organization, and especially that what's going on in the U.K. right now is really disgraceful, considering that they, hold themselves up to be a democracy. The fact that, you know, as Dan just mentioned, that hard drives were smashed in the Guardian offices, their editors are being hauled before Parliament, not to explain, you know, the complete lack of oversight going on in the GCHQ and the NSA, but to explain why they're reporting this information. And then on top of that, you know, there is talk of both Guardian journalists and David Miranda, Glenn Greenwald's partner, being charged under the Terrorism Act for essentially distributing information that has nothing to do with violence. And it's really something that you would normally see in authoritarian regimes where they lock up journalists under, you know, broad terror laws. You know, not something that we're used to in Western democracies. And it's important that people know about this and speak out against it.
And a listener, Greg, writes in, so should Snowden be prosecuted or given a Medal of Freedom? I really want an answer to this. So can you both answer Greg on that?
Are we allowed to? Do we get to decide? Is that how
it works? Yes. You are the judge and jury. Absolutely.
Marvelous.
This is your court. You're sort of FISA.
Yeah, I think the Medal of Freedom is probably pretty unlikely. But I was quite surprised that one of the rare bright spots in that CBS 60 Minutes documentary that Trevor talked about on Sunday was that a very top official at the NSA had floated the idea that there ought to be an amnesty for Snowden in return for him handing back the documents. Now, I don't know whether that's practical, and I don't know, and the White House is pretty dismissive of it. But it's clearly now increasingly hard to make the case that this is someone who should be tried for treason and espionage and all the other crimes he's been accused of here. And I think if the Supreme Court upholds the federal court decision on Monday that this is unconstitutional, I mean, Trevor's more of a legal expert than I am, but I find it incredibly hard to conceive of a situation of Snowden facing criminal trial in the U.S. at the same time as the Supreme Court rules that what he revealed is unconstitutional. I don't know. What do you think, Trevor?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he is now the first source that has ever been charged under the Espionage Act, while what he revealed was later ruled by a court to be unconstitutional. You know, obviously the court that just ruled in the past few days isn't the final say on this, and he just said that he was likely to rule it unconstitutional later when it came to him with that direct question. But it would still just be an enormous event for the government to be charging him as essentially a spy when what he revealed was found unconstitutional and potentially could go to the Supreme Court and say the same thing. I think that it's increasingly clear that, I don't know if he'll be getting the Medal of Freedom, but that he deserves definitely some sort of leniency or amnesty or immunity, given the fact that he revealed unconstitutional behavior. The government has been saying two things for the past 6 months. One, that this is legal and constitutional, and two, it's effective at stopping terrorists. We've learned in both cases this week that, number one, it's likely unconstitutional, and number two, the White House's own hand-picked panel said that they were shocked to learn that this program, this phone metadata surveillance program, had not stopped a single terrorist attack, despite the White House's and the NSA's comments for the past 6 months. So both of their cases against this program have really started to unravel. And so I think Edward Snowden has really been vindicated here and deserves a lot of credit for that.
And that's what Snowden himself said in comments released to Glenn Greenwald this week. We have a lot of emails. I'm going to read a few of them. Edward Snowden is a hero and a patriot, enough said. Why would any of us believe in what government says anymore. And Carlton writes, I don't care whether he's a patriot. Why would you ask someone whether he was a patriot toward Nazi Germany? Why do you assume that there's something positive about being a patriot? Snowden was just doing what journalists should do. But in America today, people who call themselves journalists are self-censoring and merely serve the interests of the government and the corporations that dictate its policies. Art in San Francisco writes, Holly and guests, Senator Feinstein's role as protector and promoter of the current bulk NSA surveillance has not had any scrutiny from media that I know of. She's our senator right here in the Bay Area where civil liberties have strong support, yet I haven't seen any local or national news stories that interview her on her important role as chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee or analyze why she supports the current NSA mass surveillance. Do your guests know of any such journalism? Her efforts to perpetuate NSA bulk surveillance stand out in bold contrast to this week's district court decision that called NSA surveillance almost certainly unconstitutional. Shouldn't we get more news about this, or am I just missing it? Can you guys answer this, Trevor?
Dan. Well, I think it's an extremely good point, and not enough has been written about it. I mean, we've done a little so of a few others, but I think the really interesting development as regards Senator Feinstein's cheerleading for the intelligence community, and I think it's pretty clear that's what it is that the technology community, the technology industry in California has decided to come off the fence in quite a dramatic way in the last couple of weeks, having been very, very kind of cautious about this, in fact, quite dismissive at first. We've now seen all of the large internet companies not only sign a joint letter, but troop into the White House and basically tell Obama to cut this out. Now, you know, for Obama, that's an issue. This is one of America's most successful industries. But for the senator from California, I think this is really getting to kind of be quite an issue. And I'd love to see some local reporting about what her re-election prospects are in the wake of this.
Trevor?
Yeah, I think that listener hit the nail on the head. You know, Dianne Feinstein is the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. The Senate Intelligence Committee was set up in the mid-70s after the first NSA scandal, and their number one priority was to oversee the Intelligence Committee, ask tough questions, making sure that they're not violating people's privacy. And what's happened over the past decade is it's really turned into an advocacy organization for the intelligence community instead of overseeing it. And Dianne Feinstein is the number one example of this. You know, every time, like clockwork, one of these NSA stories comes out, she is there on the front lines defending the NSA, even sometimes when she says that she actually didn't know of a certain type of spying. That literally the only time that she has gotten mad about any of these NSA stories was when it was revealed that the NSA was spying on Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel. You know, she doesn't really care when the NSA is collecting data on hundreds of millions of innocent Americans. She seemed to only care when people in power were being spied on. And, you know, I think for any voter, that's a real problem because she really doesn't have their interests in mind. And that's why I think that it's really important that along with NSA reforms that we get a truly independent commission that can investigate the NSA within Congress, because it's clear the intelligence committees have been compromised or co-opted. And, you know, it's time that we you know, have somebody that will really stand up to them and really investigate them and really act as the overseer that they were meant to be.
And in terms of the prospects for legal reforms, Judge Richard Leon said that the mass collection of phone metadata was indiscriminate and arbitrary in its scope. And he says the almost Orwellian technology that enables the government to store and analyze the phone metadata of every telephone user in the United States is unlike anything that could have been conceived in 1979. And that's a fundamental issue that sort of legal reform can never really match the pace of technological advances. What do you guys think the prospects for legal reform?
Well, I think his points there were very good, but I think they also point to the most charitable explanation for what's happened here is cock up rather than conspiracy. That the intelligence community has growing tools at its power, and nobody has told them to stop using them, and so they've just kept using them. Now there are lots more conspiratorial theories of why this happened, but that's the charitable one, and I think and that's why the point that you both just made about oversight is so important. It's only really congressional oversight that can keep that in check. We can't expect the statute to keep up with that. That's why we have congressional oversight, and that's why I think that the role of the Intelligence Committee and Senator Feinstein and others is ultimately really the cause of this. I would hold them more to blame than the NSA. The NSA are doing what they, you know, what people do.
Is push the boundaries to do your job.
Exactly.
Who in Congress is pushing for this kind of oversight, Trevor?
Well, surprisingly, the leading critic, first of all, Ron Wyden, who is the Democrat from Oregon, he's on the Intelligence Committee. He's been screaming from the rooftops about this for years now, not being able to say exactly what the NSA was doing, but because it was classified, and you know, he has a classified clearance, but warning the American people that there was a secret interpretation of the Patriot Act, and they should be very concerned about it. But surprisingly, the number one critic of this has actually been the author of the Patriot Act, Jim Sensenbrenner, the Republican from Wisconsin, who no one has ever accused of being a civil libertarian. You know, the Patriot Act has been looked at as really an encroachment on civil liberties for 10 years, you know, even beyond what the NSA was doing with it. And, you know, he was the author of it. But he has been leading the charge, saying that he did not write the Patriot Act to allow this mass surveillance where, you know, tens of millions or hundreds of millions of innocent Americans were being swept up in a dragnet. You know, the Patriot Act was written to go after people who were under investigation, not everybody. And so he has now written what is called the USA Freedom Act, which tries to, you know, it doesn't go all the way, it doesn't solve all of the problems with the NSA, but it really tries to implement substantive reform, you know, reform to the secret FISA court so that we get to find out the decisions and they're released to the public, and so it's not just a one-sided court, and, you know, reform to this mass phone records database where the government wouldn't be able to collect it on everybody, bringing real transparency to these issues. And so, you know, it's been great to see that people who normally wouldn't pay attention to privacy or have normally been on the other side of these issues really switch sides given that what they've seen. And, you know, it's really telling that Congress was never really informed of what the NSA was doing to begin with.
And, Dan, very quickly, in like 30 seconds, what are you going to be focusing on in 2014?
I'm afraid to say this story. I think the next few weeks are possibly the most crucial that we have here. If a Democratic president who's a former constitutional law professor can't roll back the surveillance state, given the overwhelming evidence now in front of him, I don't think anybody can. So I think the next few weeks, while in the run-up to the State of the Union address, are probably the most crucial that this country has faced for a long time.
And we'll be following that, and we're going to post all of the articles you heard about today at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can continue this conversation by posting information about NSA or other stories this week that you think are important. We've been speaking with Dan Roberts, who's The Guardian's Washington Bureau Chief, and Trevor Tim, who's co-founder and executive director of the new Freedom of the Press Foundation. There's links to all of that information at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
And thanks for having us.
Also thanks to Sandeep Roy, who joined us for the first part of the show. He's culture editor for firstpost.com and a commentator for Morning Edition on NPR. Thanks to everybody who emailed and called. I apologize that we couldn't get to everything. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call.
What makes a good charity? On the next Your Call, we'll rebroadcast a conversation about how to find out if a charity is trustworthy. The Center for Investigative Reporting issued a report this year called America's Worst Charities, and it says hundreds of charities claim to help those in need, but of the millions of dollars raised each year, how much goes to cancer patients, disabled vets, and dying children? Almost nothing. So what questions should we be asking about the organizations we donate to? That's on the next Your Call with Holly Kernan and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.